Mini episode 367 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.info.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to FDH Lounge. Mini episode number 367. You've got FDH Lounge dignitaries, original dignitaries, Rick Morris and Jason Jones coming at you tonight discussing the just completed episode 5.1 of Justified. We are taping this in real time, having just seen the season premiere, and we'll be doing this throughout the course of the season. I like to under-promise whenever and wherever I can, so I can't swear in blood that he and I are going to be able to get together every week, but I will promise you that I will have up some form of a recap or analysis every week with the program, and he and I are certainly optimistic, I'll put it that way, of being able to do this every week. And a lot of times I think we will probably do this right off the bat after having watched it, if it works out. Jason, good to have you on, my man. This is the first one that you have watched in real time after four seasons of cramming, watching it in 16 days last summer. How did it feel watching it in real time for the first time?
That's my answer. you know, I'm watching this thing as we're going from segment to segment, and yes, they're introducing new characters, and we're seeing some old stuff come up, and it's great. But there wasn't that sort of holy moment, except it just happened while you were filling, if you will.
I was able to catch a little bit there. Now, I don't remember the names of the Clover Hill guys from last year. I think that was Lee. I think the funeral home guy is Lee. And he was, him and Boyd were going at it there a little bit. Why don't you talk about what happened in that scene? Because I would say I picked up kind of the gist of it, but you were able to catch it a little bit more closely, I'm sure.
Well, yeah, if you go back to previous seasons, there was that whole scenario where Boyd was asserting himself to the, you know, the aristocracy of, you know, Harlan County or whatever. And they basically told him, you know, there's a right and wrong way to do things, and you don't get to just come in and, you know, stake your claim. And that's where Boyd kind of said, yeah, that's where you're wrong. And then, you know, later on, a couple episodes later, they're at the bar with Boyd, and Boyd basically says, this house is going to be whether you like it or not. So Boyd's showing up at Paxton's place of business, as Paxton said, figuratively begging on his knees, was gratifying enough, and essentially asked Boyd that if Boyd would put in writing that he was responsible for the death of Devil and forced Ava to move the body, that he'd be more than happy to get Ava out of prison. But that would mean that Boyd is going down for a long period of time, which naturally wasn't going to work for Boyd Crowder. So shortly thereafter, Boyd decides that, okay, no deal can be made here, so I'm just going to bludgeon this man in the face with the butt of my pistol. In typical Boyd fashion.
Yeah, you're seeing a more reckless Boyd Crowder, sort of a reversion to season one. If you remember when he was almost a pure loose cannon in the early days, that's what it feels like we're getting this year. A little bit of back to the basics for him, because in seasons 2, 3, and 4, he was really more of sort of the philosopher warrior, you know, a guy who, you know, would give you these flowery talks and, you know, who really thought through his stuff. He almost seems to be going more back to basics. I have to ask you, this is something we didn't talk about in the season 5 preview. There's a little bit of a criticism of the show that I've seen, and I almost kind of subscribe to it a little bit, as much as I love it. I try to be intellectually honest. But the whole thing season 4, the introduction of Clover Hill, little bit of the term of deus ex machina, where, and I probably bungled the pronunciation of it, but of where the writers will just kind of throw something in. You know, these people, you and I have talked about this off air, how we wish that perhaps it were a 22-episode season, or that it allowed for in terms of actor availability. And I'd love to see someday, I hope we get some backstory scenes. I hope they get the actors that are off the show back together for some flashback scenes, because it would be awesome. Like Max Bennett and Bo Crowder and all of them, and maybe Limehouse. But the introduction of Clover Hill and this whole thing of like, yeah, we're these rich guys who've been secretly pulling the strings this whole time. And, you know, that's why your whorehouse is able to operate, because of us. Did it feel a little bit sudden to you, the way they were dropped onto the canvas? Because I must confess, it did feel a little sudden to me.
Well, yeah, there was at that point, there was this whole, you thought you had a grip on the community, the, you know, the towns and whatnot. It did sort of feel like, as you're watching, it's like, oh, by the way, there's this function with these old people that like to swing, and I think I can get an invitation. If we can go there, we can really rub elbows with some power brokers. And it looked like an advantageous situation. But from that point on, it was kind of, it felt a little rushed. I mean, it just happened, and then Boyd did what Boyd does, and then next thing you know, we didn't hear from him for a while, until we're back at that bar scene where Boyd basically says, I'm, you know, taking it over whether you like it or not.
Well, the other thing, too, and I don't want to beat this point to death, but I do want to analyze it, because you and I are not going to be afraid to go in-depth on this kind of stuff also. Maybe it was a little bit facetious, but I remember when Johnny Crowder was cooperating toward the end of the season, when he was cutting a deal with Raylan, he sort of bitterly said something about, you know, Boyd's getting his house in the suburbs. And I'm thinking to myself, and again, maybe I'm too much of a literalist, because I like to look at a map when I see this, and I see where Harlan County is and everything like that. You are dotted with towns that probably have nothing but triple-digit populations for as far as the eye can see. Suburbs? You know, it's like, I guess we're supposed to believe that Harlan County is a little bit more populous than it really is, but I'm looking at this, and this whole thing of, like, where do rich people live? And I've been to rural America, Jason. I went to the Harvard on the Hocking. I drove in and out of rural America for 4 years. And this notion of, like, well, this is the enclave of where the rich people are. There are no concentrations of rich people mansions in rural America. There just aren't. So I don't know. Maybe it's not a huge, you know, thing. Maybe I'm picking nits here. I mean, there are nice houses. Don't get me wrong. But there's not the segregation by wealth in rural America that there is in urban and suburban America. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. I can tell you right now that that we live in a modest part of town. You know, we've got University of Colorado Hospital down the street. We have downtown Denver, maybe 10 minutes away. However, if you drive from here to downtown Denver, about halfway down, you know, all of a sudden the mansions come sprouting out of the ground. I get that because it's Denver. You know, millions of people live here. And I agree with you. My family lives came from that stretch that you're talking about. My grandparents and great-grandparents grew up in those small towns between Athens and Cleveland. So I know what you mean. There's no concentration of anything, really, in rural America that I'm aware of, the rural America that I've seen. I did find that funny because when I went back to watch getting ready for tonight's episode, even as recently as the Hole in the Wall episode, episode one of season four, you know, where Drew falls, or the guy falls out of the plane and crash lands in this very nice cul-de-sac with these more than modest homes. I mean, the guy that walks out to get his paper is in a house that I don't believe exists in Harlan County, anywhere in Harlan County. And then there's even this moment where you see him, and then the camera pans around like 150 degrees, and you see like the entire neighborhood. And you go, wait a minute, this is, you know, this is like the suburbs of Bel Air, not Harlan County. So I totally get what you're saying, and there are parts of this that you have to kind of just suspend reality for a bit. And I'm sure like you, and probably at around the same juncture you did in real time, I also Google mapped the damn thing. Because I wanted to see, you know, where is Harlan County in relation to Lexington, in relation to everything else. And I even did the Google Earth thing where I can see, you know, the types of buildings or the metropolis. And guess what? There ain't no metropolis in Harlan County.
No.
Even though they would like to lead you down that path.
No, and that's... I love that you brought up the cul-de-sac. That is, because I don't think you and I even talked about that off air. And that's the same. I knew exactly where you were going with that when you started talking. Because that's the same thought I had. They're like, this is not Harlan County. You know, this is suburbia, USA. Plus, Jason,
hey, Westlake doesn't look that nice.
Yeah. Well, not only that. Not only that. This happened in 1983. So, you know, I mean, and there's been a look. There's a little bit more, okay? There are some more touches of suburban America in spots of rural America in 2014 now, as opposed to 1983. There's a little bit more of that, but there's still not nearly that much. So, yeah, that's okay. That's outstanding that you picked up on that. Once again, me and you thinking alike. But ultimately, yeah, tonight we were introduced to some new characters. And one of the things that I thought was very interesting, you talked about this in our Season 5 preview, about Season 4 and maybe a little bit of Season 3, the world is getting a little bit bigger. Mostly the introduction of the Detroit characters as they were coming down to Harlan County. So you've got Detroit, which has kind of lingered in the background as a force, and Miami. You know, it's where Raylan came from. Haven't seen much in the way from Miami since Season 1. But if you're thinking about the two geographic locations outside of Kentucky that have played a part in this show, it's been Detroit and Miami. Tonight we experienced them both to the almost complete exclusion of Kentucky. I won't say equidistant because that would be lazy of me to say, you know, they're about the same distance away. Roughly they probably are, but I don't know how roughly they are. You had Boyd going up to Detroit. You had Raylan going down to Miami, each pursuing their own sort of disparate path here. So, in a way, I can't think back of any episodes of the first four seasons like this. It was a little bit jarring having so little of this on the Kentucky canvas. It almost felt like maybe they were shooting it a little bit different, too. I thought I saw a few more quick cuts here and there, a little bit more of a noir kind of feel to it a little bit. I may just be imagining that on first viewing, but what were your thoughts on seeing probably the most non-Kentucky episode of Justified we've ever seen?
Well, I think the first thing to take from that is I was going into tonight with a certain expectation, which was not met. Now, that's not to say it's a bad thing. It just was totally different. No Gutterson, no Rachel. I don't even think Art was in the mix for more than a minute or two. Yeah, there wasn't that... I guess from the first four seasons, we've been kind of accustomed to, at any given point, you're going to be dominated by Raylan and Boyd, and then their respective immediate whatever. But you're also going to see some ancillary bad guy figures, you know, whether that be Limehouse or Mags or whatever. You're also going to see Ava v. Winona, and we didn't really see that. They were done completely separately and away from home. There was a whole lot that just didn't fit what one would describe as the Justified episodic blueprint, which may be an indication that things are going to get a little different here, and that's perfectly fine. But it was absolutely different. I mean, you did have, you know, Dewey Crow in the beginning of the episode, which was, you know, nice little homecoming there. But it was very different. The one thing I'll take from it that I really did appreciate, and this is something that they always do, is you knew Raylan's going to be Raylan no matter what, and he's familiar with Miami, so it wasn't that big of a stretch. But what I really appreciated was when Boyd ventures out of his comfort zone and heads up to Detroit, which, by the way, I have not been to Detroit in a very, very, very long time. I understand that they're not doing so well. But why did it seem like they were post-apocalyptic Detroit, but just throwing that out there. But the overall point being, when Boyd went to a place he wasn't familiar with, he didn't hesitate at all in his Boyd Crowderness, which I appreciated.
Yeah, he asserted himself full on. Wynn was a little bit more cautious, but that's sort of more in his nature. He's more cautious on everything than Boyd is. That's the nature of how he rolls. As far as it went, yeah, I agree with you on that. It was a thing of where the Detroit mob, again, they could certainly afford better accommodations in Greater Detroit, one would think. But, yeah, they're however many, 14 stories up it was in this crappy building. I mean, I guess we were supposed to believe that Sammy and his top leadership were hiding from the Canadian mafia. But again, showing that the Detroit mob had gone into such disrepair since, I guess it makes sense because it was the Sammy going down tonight. That was the first big, the third big decapitation hit in the Detroit mob. Theo is over in exile in Tunisia, never coming back after the Drew Thompson revelations of season four, and Nicky Augustine. Fighting. And actually, if you think about that, those are the three ones right there. If I go back a season to Quarles, Quarles was maybe not quite the underboss level that Nicky was at. But I guess if you look at it, that a guy like Sammy, who we were led to believe was going to be a very weak leader if he ever took it over, yeah, it wouldn't take long to erode underneath him. But very interesting that Picker, who looked like the consummate kind of beta dog toward the end of season four, and what did he say to Sam, to Raylan right before they rubbed out Nicky Augustine about something about, the higher up you are, the bigger the fall. What a misdirection that was. But he's a very, very interesting character. I love remembering about how you said you squeal like a pig when you saw that he was in the nursery with Winona toward the end of last season. Uh-huh. So Picker looks like he's still going to be in the mix. You got these Canadians that are kind of interesting. So it did feel a lot different. I will say this, and I'm the same as you. I thought tonight was pretty good, but it didn't really enthrall me. But I'm okay with that. It's like I want to see where it's going. It's setting the pace. I want to see what the season is. I am going to put a marker down and say this. If the show becomes less Kentucky-oriented, I'm going to lose a little enthusiasm. I don't think they're going there. I don't think so. But, I don't want to see it deviate from the world.
A couple quick things there. The whole first thought, I'm getting ahead of myself. First thought, and this is very American-centric, and anybody listening that's Canadian, I apologize in advance. But when the hell are we supposed to believe that a Detroit mob entity is going to run away with their tail tucked between their legs from the Canadians?
I know.
Anyway, staying with the Canadian mob, I do enjoy the two guys that they got to represent this Canadian mob were Will Sasso of Mad TV fame.
That was him?
I forget the guy's
name. Wow.
Yeah.
I thought that was him.
Yeah, and then the other guy was, I forget his name, but the only reason I even know who he is from Strangers with Candy, which is another sketch comedy bit. So both being, from that whole sketch improv comedy world, and they're both Canadian, if I'm not mistaken, anyway. So it was interesting, and I love the line, I thought all Canadians were supposed to be polite or nice or whatever the line was, and then Will Sasso, deadpan as possible, says, yeah, wrong Canadians. So I'm interested in that whole thing, but more importantly, it feels, this whole thing tonight just feels like, the carrot on the string. It feels like we're being set up for something, and it's good because you've got the element of No More Sammy Tonin. You've got the new introduction of the Canadian mob. You've got the Florida Crows claiming that Florida is tapped out. And then the last line, I don't know if you caught that, was the kid that played – some guy that dies in X-Men First Class a couple years ago, the black guy, the Haitian, said something about, do you have a cousin in Kentucky? And I get the impression that Canadian mob, these Florida interests, along with the Florida Crows, there's going to be something with Winona because she's there. I wouldn't be surprised if all of these storylines come within a few episodes and descend upon Kentucky. And we're right back to our comfortable setting, but we are once again, as always, in conflict with parties from outside.
The one thing that I read, I think it was on the TV Guide website, I don't remember exactly, but I think it was there, that indicated that the Crows, and we saw it tonight with Michael Rapaport playing Dale Crow, head of that crime family down in Florida.
Which is going to be great.
Making their way. Yeah, he was. He was really interesting. And that they'll be making their way to Harlan, and that it's going to be almost like, it was compared to like an invasive kind of thing, like the Asian carp, as far as somebody who doesn't really fit into the local fabric anymore, but just creates chaos, much as like an invasive creature would do, that will be their effect upon Harlan County. And so they'll be making their way there. And Dewey going to be a part of things. Dewey in that great opening scene with Judge Reardon, played by Stephen Root, who is one of my favorite character actors. Stephen Root is just consistently awesome.
Real quick, just for anyone who hasn't seen it yet or you're waiting on the DVR, in that cold open, the first few minutes, it's your typical scene, but I'm just telling you to wait for the moment when he says, you know, blah, 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 I'm only going to get $300. He has to be the only person in the whole courtroom, the whole building, maybe even the zip code, that would have got that.
It's just the judge's exasperation, too. Well, I got to tell you, because he's been in so many great roles and loved him on news radio. And when I was first told, I can't even remember the guy's name, if it's Melvin or whatever it is, but the stapler guy from Office Space, when I was told that guy was played by Steve Root too, yeah, I was like, you got to be kidding me. That guy just rose even more in my esteem. So
the funny thing is about the time that Office Space came out was about the first time that I actually started paying attention to, you know, who played who, with the exception of, you know, your big Hollywood stars. And I got to say, going backwards, Stephen Root's amazing. If you go back and look at his resume, in my mind, up until maybe a couple years ago, I literally thought of him as the Office Space guy who maybe did this, maybe did that. And then you really step out of it, he's really solid. He's done a lot of crazy stuff. He's all over the board. Never gets typecasted, really, and he's a phenomenal piece. And sort of as your reaction off air was when the episode first started, you kind of, even as a fan of the show in general, the second you see Judge Reardon, you're like, oh yeah, it's a Judge Reardon episode.
That's how I feel, and it's so funny too. Somebody had to tell me that he was the guy from Office Space, because that was different than how I've seen him in a lot of his other roles. And I was just like, I have an even greater respect for the guy, because, you know, it's for somebody who's been primarily in comedic type roles, to speak of their range, it sounds unusual, but it's like that guy can make you laugh in 92 different ways. You know, it's just, and I think he could carry serious roles also. I haven't seen him in those as much, but what you said about Will Sasso earlier on, I thought that was him as one of the two Canadian mobsters. But, yeah, that just nailed it there. Again, we talked about it leading into Season 5, the casting, everything that they do, how strong that is. There's another character that's going to be coming on the canvas that we didn't see tonight, Amy Smart, who is going to play somebody who is, I believe, a social worker in the federal office there in Lexington, and she becomes involved with Raylan subsequently, and she is a very colorful character. She was shown briefly at the very end as far as the coming attractions for the season. And, again, there are so many threats that are kind of put out there tonight. We're going to be seeing what happens with Ava in prison subsequently, everything with Winona down in Florida with the baby. That was – Again, I didn't know she had family down there or whatever the thing was that caused her to move down there. That seemed kind of sudden that she ended up down there. But I bet you're right. I'll bet that ties back in somehow, her proximity to the Crow family.
There's something there.
Yeah.
There's something there we're missing. And a lot of times you say, well, that was abrupt. And it was, but I think it's abrupt because there's a detail we're missing. A part of me says maybe it's just that that's the only other place that Raylan knows people, and maybe he told her, take the baby, go down here, we'll set you up, and at least this way I don't have to worry about, you know, guys coming in the night. So I don't know what it is, but any experience with this show, there's a red flag with that one. There's something going on there. She didn't just up and move because she felt like it.
Absolutely. You know what? As far as other marginal pieces on the canvas, I know for a fact this is not a guy we talked about leading into season 5 because I would have remembered it. Fairly marginal guy, background a lot, but always interesting when he's on. AUSA Vasquez, we saw him in the opener tonight. He was in the courtroom scene, and he was the one basically cutting the deal to pay off Dewey Crowe on that. It was very interesting because they were building it last season in terms of the Drew Thompson thing, and if this is going to make Raylan, this is going to make his career, you know, as Rachel said at one point, he may become the boss of The Office. I guess in the opening scene there, it was really kind of a deft thing that the writers did as far as showing you why the show is not changing in that way, why Raylan has not been given this big promotion that would drastically change the nature of the show, because at the end of the day, he's still a guy who's going to screw up, cuff somebody like Dewey Crowe around a little bit too much, and cost Uncle Sam 300 grr.
Yeah, they kept suggesting such a promotion, and I just never saw it. And I hate to say this because I really don't like it when writers think this way, but there are certain things that happen that make you think, well, that would be the end of the series. And the one I hate the most is, not that I'm a huge fan of the show anyway, but people always said, well, the moment Rachel and Ross get together, Friends is over. Well, no, not necessarily. Don't be lazy. To agree with that idea that one thing would end the show is a little silly, but in this case, the whole draw of this show is based on the idea that Raylan Givens is a deputy marshal in the field. Second you take him out of the field, doesn't it become a spinoff? I mean, it loses a lot if that's the case.
Yeah.
So I never really believed that they were going to do that, and if they did, they were going to hold off until towards the end of the series. But on the other hand, I guess art can't do it forever. Interesting side note as we're talking about actors and where they come from, I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think that Vasquez is also the sandwich guy from Ugly Betty, which would really help any claim that he is a good actor with range to go from Ugly Betty to Justified.
Well, you know what, and I think that is, again, another example of the casting we talked about and the genius of that. So much of the genius of the show comes from showrunner Graham Yost, co-executive producer Timothy Oliphant, who is a big part of the creative, as well as being an actor on the show, the lead actor, and Elmore Leonard, who wrote the novels upon which the Raylan Givens character in the world of Harlan and the Marshall's office in Lexington was created. Elmore Leonard, unfortunately, passing away last summer. A little bit of a tribute to him at the beginning of the show. I did read online that it's going to be a big part of the Season 5 DVD. They're going to have a very extended tribute to him on there. Unfortunately, that will be probably just about at the end of 2014 that comes out. And here we are at the beginning of it, so we only have to wait about, you know, 10 or 11 months for that. But it'll be worth seeing. It was a great tribute at the beginning, and it was great to see the actors out of character talking about Elmore Leonard, what he meant to this world.
Yeah, I to be honest, had no idea that he was the, I guess, stalwart that he was in the writing community. 45 books. I had no idea there were 45 of them. And it wouldn't bother me one bit if they took this cast and made 45 feature films, so, which they're not going to do. But really good stuff. And there was a nice little bit in that little mini tribute was Boyd's character, Goggins, I think is the last name, reading an excerpt from the pilot episode as it appears in the scripts, or as it appears in the written text, however you want to see it. And it was interesting how those words arranged the way they are don't mean anything. But then as he's reading it, and then they crossfade over to actual justified footage, you go, oh, wow. He really was good at what he did. And I can absolutely see how any interview you ever watch of these people, they always rave up and down about how you have to do it right. And he's a character guy, and if you do it wrong, it's not going to be any good. If you do it right, it's going to be phenomenal, which is, guy, you got to give a lot of credit to that man for what he put together in the book form, and that these guys are good enough to translate it accurately on screen, because it is a phenomenal show.
And that's the greatness of the show. They adhered to it strictly. They've had the credo of what would Elmore do really from day one, and they basically intend to kind of continue along those lines. It's regrettable here that as we reach the very end, I don't have the time for a full-blown discussion on this part, but I do want to put this out there just for you to react to. Slate Magazine, which I have always found to be, in recent years especially, something that's just dedicated to trolling on different things. They troll a lot politically, especially to people of my political persuasion, but they troll on a lot of different things. I don't know if you saw this. They put up a thing there, and they're part of this whole hipster contingent I've told you about. Season 2 was the best ever. They put up a thing on there today in the headline, railing it in. Justified is still better than almost anything else, but it's not the show it once was. And it's talking about season 3 and season 4, which you and I have talked about how they've expanded the world and everything like that. And here's what they say. As a comedic procedural, Justified remains aces. As a thought-provoking drama, well, Raylan's pants continue to fit him very nicely. They accuse the show of slumming. So I just thought I'd let you pee off on that with some well-earned outrage here at the end.
Well, you know, you and I can have a conversation, and we can even share it with the world, and that's lovely. I would really relish any opportunity that we have, if you ever feel like doing it, to reaching out to these, trying to keep this politically correct, we'll just call them idiots for the moment, and I would love to roast them on air for all to enjoy, because and I'll go as far as say anyone, who thinks that season 2 is monumentally, if not at all, better than the others, we can go point, counterpoint, and we can absolutely roast them on a skewer. Because here's the thing. Really great shows, and I'm experiencing this with Breaking Bad now. I've experienced it with West Wing for a while, and then they got to a point where it was just too much and it wasn't as good anymore. But generally speaking, these good shows, I'm not a Mad Men person, so I can't speak to that, or Walking Dead, but I'd be willing to bet that in the last 5 years, all of the shows that are consistently nominated for Emmys, that are considered to be the best television has to offer, like Justified, grows in a manner consistent and intentional with the writer's wishes. Meaning, yes, you could start with season 1 and grow into season 2 and grow into season 3 and grow into season 4 and so on, and keep building and keep adding to the stack and keep spreading the foundation out and making this bigger and bigger and bigger until, guess what, newsflash, ultimately the whole damn thing has to come crumbling down. That's the point. I have a feeling as I get towards the end of Breaking Bad that's going to be the scenario, but that's for a whole other show. The idea that they would take this brilliant man's work, his lifelong work of 45 novels, and all this stuff, all his background, and all the work that you know and I know that the writing staff and the directing staff and the production staff goes through great lengths to get right, that they wouldn't do season 1 and then season 2 and just let the bottom fall out.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Club,
Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Paper Mate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.